Live from Seattle, Washington, it's the Chris Perillo Show. Each week, Chris breaks down the latest technology trends, providing answers to your questions, conversations with tech luminaries, and the latest buzz from across the web. Now, here's Chris.
Daemons out there because they were security holes, for some reason. You know, if it were opening a file that happened to be an executable or something like that, it could be exploited, or that there was some kind of, you know, overrun or underrun or some kind of hack that they could do to get root privileges off of this thing that all it does is you connect to a port on this machine and it reads a text file, you know. So
that's
instead of like trying to fix it or anything like that, it was just such a trivial thing to just shut it down.
Yeah. You know? Well, in nowadays, you know, you never hear about those other services that are out there. No one really uses Gopher anymore. I think there was an exploit, like an Internet Explorer with Gopher, and this, you know, who uses Gopher anymore?
And Microsoft's like, dude, we do Gopher?
Yeah, like, okay. But it's something that you can really appreciate if you were around before. Well, I'd say if you were before 1995, like Windows 3.1 days, yep. You know, even OS, when the big war was between OS 2 and Windows.
Yeah.
I mean, Mac was just kind of off on its own, and, you know, then OS 2, of course, went to the wayside.
Well, and when NCSA Mosaic or even earlier web browsers, the only way that you would ever see them was at the X terminal.
Yeah.
On the, you know, in your computing lab. If you actually knew what they did in the first place, you know, Mosaic in 91 or 92 was one of a handful of things that you could, you know, that had the sort of same approach. There were Gopher clients and things like that, and the idea of transmitting graphics over your 2400 baud modem, which is what most of my friends in college had at the time, unless they could cough up $200 for a 14.4.
Oh man!
And you know, but then I mean, there was no concept of SLIP or PPP connections or anything like that for a lot of us because our administrators wouldn't give them to us. And then you know, what did you have for ISPs outside of that? Like NetComm, you might have been okay.
CompuServe, yeah. AOL,
CompuServe,
was just
AOL, Delphi, Genie,
Prodigy.
None of those had any concept of it until 94, 95, 96.
Yeah.
So, you know, you had to, you know, there were some genius hacks like a shell program. Like you would get a shell account from your ISP or your university, and you dial in and run this. You know, run this program on your server to emulate SLIP, and it was slow. Finally, you had this. I can run all of I can run the web on my machine. I can do I can transfer big files, and I don't have to X modem them or Z modem them across after the fact.
And of course, big files were like 200K.
Yeah,
you
totally.
Know? Those are just huge.
Yeah, and unfathomable. Like 10-minute downloads. It was
We had to use Kermit. That was another, I don't know if it was an actual protocol, but it was definitely a client. And I ended up getting that's what they recommended to use was Kermit at my university. And I ended up started using Telix, T-E-L-I-X, to dial in. And that was the easiest way that, you know, I could get into the internet using the university servers. They had a pool of 2400 baud modems and then a pool of 14.4, and that was as high as it went. No, 9600. I don't think they went as high as 14.4. But I remember chomping at the bit when I had a 14.4 modem and they had a Sportster US Robotics Sportster 288 modem at the local computer store. It was like $200-$300, and I was just like, oh man.
And the courier. So the US Robotics made the Sportster, which was like the one you could afford, and the Courier, which was the one you really wanted, like the one that could be upgraded with like had firmware upgradability and things like that, and it was like $500.
And you know, the thing is you're going for more speed, and nowadays, you know, you argue between cable and DSL. You could actually do network gaming, like Doom 2. I remember very clearly playing Doom 2 on a 14.4 connection with a friend who was on the other side of campus. And now, you know, nowadays, it just blows it away. But these things, we were really there when they were starting to take off. I mean, when Doom hit, it didn't bite me. Doom, I was still very much into ISCA and the interaction and, you know, talking with others and meeting other people and networking than I was with, you know, shoot 'em up, you know, play.
So you were more interested in meeting other people than you were in killing other people, is what you're saying.
Yes, so I guess I'm socially maladjusted to a certain degree. Because it seems that most
are socially adjusted.
No, but most of society. I just got Halo 2 the other day. I haven't even unwrapped it yet. I haven't had time. I got
Halo 2 and I'm stuck on this one level. I've blown away everything I need to blow away, and I go back and there's like no way to get out of it. I'm stumped. I opened it up. I popped it in. I sat there for like 45 minutes just, you know, leveling. Going, how do I get out of this level?
So you haven't, like, searched for any workarounds? Or
I haven't. I mean, I know there's going to be just something. Like, I got to push a button in a wall. But, like, I went and I blew up the big bad guy from the wrong part of the room. And, I messed up the flow of the game. And as a result, I must pay.
Oh, man. You know, that's the thing about games. And I like them when they're nice and simple. I can pick them up, put them down. And to a certain degree, you know, instant messaging and email is much the same way. I'd prefer asynchronous interaction with my computer, depending on what it is, of course. Certain things need, you know, immediate response time. But gaming for me is it's fun, but man, I could not spend any time on it. Otherwise, dude, what would I do for a living?
Yeah, right. Like, that's the thing. Halo 2 was the first game that I've had in, I don't know, probably a year. And I used to have, I mean, I've had every game system you can imagine, but for the last, you know, 3 years or so, I've just had no time to actually sit down and play with it. You know, when I was working for .com, I had all kinds of time because, you know, I was working at home. And Tony Hawk 2 was a lot more compelling than, you know, rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic.
Well, we'll get back to your .com stories and talk a little bit further about what you're doing now, specifically with a .org at this point, the W3C. We've got another song queued up, or I'm not sure exactly what's the second on the list. Do we have another German rapper at this point?
I think we are fresh out of German rappers, although I could probably find some more German if people want to listen to it. I even know what to look for, but...
Track two.
Okay, this is a group. This is actually a local group. They're from, I believe, Tacoma or Olympia. Olympia. They're called Scream Club, and they're this really trippy sort of two woman hip hop group. So this song is Scream Club featuring Mira, the Ben Adorable remix of Dead Wrong. I wanna talk to all you addicts out there.
Grasping at straws and crying out loud. forgot how to have a good time with my sad attitude and the way I behave. It's no wonder that no one has come to save me.
So you were a dot-commer.
I was.
You actually worked for a legitimate dot-com.
Yes.
So you were like at home playing video games on VC money.
Well, at the very end, it was just we had this. Okay, I'll go through the whole story because this is one of the Seattle like sort of heartbreaker stories, because we had, you know, up here we had you know, things like Cosmo and My Lackey and, you know, that were really fun, you know, sites to frequent, because, you know, you could just, you know, if you had the munchies and you wanted to watch a DVD and you were too bored, you know, it was too boring to you to actually go out and buy this stuff, then Cosmo would actually come to you, and that was fantastic. But my.com was homegrocer.com, and I joined them in, you know, right at the beginning, like June, July of 98. And, you know, sort of help build this, you know, this big service that, you know, everyone sort of, you know, when I mentioned that, you know, that I was with Home Grocer, they're like, oh, wow, that's great. You know, I love, you know, I order my groceries from you all the time and all of this stuff. And so that was a lot of fun. And then, you know, we went public the day that NASDAQ stopped going up. The day that NASDAQ hit like 5,100. March 10th, 2000.
That was the day of the IPO?
That was the day homegrocer.com IPO'd.
Wow.
And
yeah,
I bet someone was
PO'd.
Oh, yeah. We had this, you know, little pop. We finally got the venture capital that we wanted. And then it was just this constant slide, just a steady slide down to zero. And, I mean, that was happening across the industry. So our biggest competitor was Webvan down in San Francisco. And they had gotten so much venture capital. They had like $250 million in VC before they sold a bag of groceries.
Wow.
And, you know, we went through this period where, you know, our venture capital people, our first investors are going, just wait, market'll still be there, And of course the market's like gone in March of 2000. So, you know, we were completely at a loss because we didn't have the kind of capital just kind of gutted out as we were getting fairly close to having something that was really viable in the long term. So, you know, we had apparently just had a bunch of merger talks, and the joke was that one of the companies that was interested in us was saying, you're going to love it in Bentonville. So we didn't want to be bought by Walmart. So we ended up, you know, merging with Webvan. And so when we merged with Webvan, I was like, first thing I did was like, I'm out of here. You know, I start interviewing around, and I, you know, a couple of job offers here and there I wasn't really interested in doing what they were doing at the time, and so I ended up like moving my position down to Foster City. So I was shuttling back and forth to San Francisco every 2 weeks.
Oh man!
So I'm there for 2 days out of every 2 weeks, and not like in San Francisco, but in Foster City, like on the peninsula. It's just the most boring town. I'm sorry. I hope I'm not offending anybody, and I'm pretty sure that I'm not, because I don't think that anyone actually lives in Foster City. I think it's just a bunch of buildings that periodically house people that are sucking down venture capital. But so I'm going down there, and you know, I'm on, you know, special projects, he said with those little quotey fingers. And, you know, I'm doing things like Palm applications and PDA applications, and you know, or like the WAP version of the site, and doing usability testing and things like that. But there's only so much of that that's actually worth doing, right? So I'm finished with my work. I can't think of anything else to do. I don't have a usability lab in my office. I've done all of my mock-ups. I've done all of my designs. What am I going to do? Okay, my Dreamcast and my Tony Hawk 2 were beckoning. So they basically just sort of paid me, and you know, to show up periodically, and then I, you know, then they went, you know, belly up, and I was free to do that full time.
Well, it must have worked, because you now have graduated to Halo 2.
I have graduated to Halo 2, although, like I said, you know, we're talking the amount of hours that I played Tony Hawk in a day is more than I've played on my Xbox on anything in the last year.
Yeah.
So,
well, you're it depends on if your time is being used wisely.
Yeah.
And it seems that, you know, we've obviously moved past the BBS addiction.
Yes.
We're no longer working for a failed.com.
Yes.
We are now working, and I say the we as in the you.
Yes. The royal we.
The royal we. We are working for the W3C.
Yes.
And that's very, very interesting. And maybe you can clearly define what it is that the W3C does. Number one. Number two, tell me why Microsoft doesn't listen to you.
Oh, boy. Okay. I will say what I can about this. The W3C is an industry consortium, and actually it's not just an industry consortium. We have a third of our members are nonprofits and universities and that kind of thing. But the, you know, the funding from W3C, among other sources, comes from companies and organizations related to the web. So, you know, of which you have names like Microsoft and Apple and IBM and so forth. So, in that respect, I take a lot of .com money. But
at least you feel good about it.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, the group that I work in, which is the Web Accessibility Initiative, actually is funded from a lot of other sources. Like, you know, we have a handful of sponsors who are also W3C members, but are paying more in specifically for accessibility. And then we have the, you know, National Institute for Disability and Rehabilitation Research here, Assistive Devices Industry Office in Canada, the European Commission gives us money to do our work. So I consume a lot less of that money than many of my colleagues. But, you know, what we do with that is, you know, we develop the formats and standards of the web, more or less, you know, the majority of what's out there, your HTMLs, your, you know, SVGs, and your SOAP and WSDL and
RDF 1.1 I saw the other day.
Well, RSS 1.1.
Is it RSS now? Are you calling it RSS officially now, or
no,
is it still
well,
RDF?
Okay. There's RDF. Okay, there's the Research Description Framework language, which became a recommendation last year. I'm pretty sure it was 2004. But the that is just the framework upon which the RDF site summary version, the RSS 1.0 and
right.
Now 1.1, okay. Is based. So. So that's actually that's a work that goes on outside of W3C. There are you know, a number of you know, sort of semantic web adherents who are working on that kind of stuff, and you know, to that end, you know, I'm not going to get into the format debate between RSS 1.0 and RSS 2.0.
I'm with you on that. Yeah, so.
But there's a compelling reason if you look at it from the viewpoint of the semantic web to do it that way. So,
and not to sidestep, and I think you've given us a good overview of, you know, what your function is, but when someone says the semantic web, they're not talking about a simple web page. Are they talking about relationships?
Right. They're talking about I see the W3C director, Tim Berners-Lee, fairly often. And, at least a couple, three times a year. And I kind of walk up to him and I say, what is the semantic web? And he goes, well, basically it's the web of data. You know, you have this data that's sitting out there on the web. And you can discern from an HTML web page what is the header and what is the, you know, what's a list and so forth. And in the early days of the web, and I say that from, 1994 until 2004.
Were you still addicted back then to the BBS, or had you moved past that at that point?
What do you mean?
Around that time frame. Were you still sucked in?
I was coming out of it around 95 or 96, and I closed my last account at the end of 2002. It was just kind of sitting there wasting my time, so I decided to waste my time with other things.
Okay.
So, anyway, the idea of the semantic web is that this data has a universal meaning. You know, you can go and the UPC code on this website corresponds to the UPC code on this website, mm-hmm. and how it's presented to you is just the icing on top of it. Now, if you had the ability to go out into the web and say, I want to find all of the sites on the web that sell this precise product. You know, you have things like Frugal or, shopper.com or whatever that kind of guess, right? They have a pretty good idea from the one-liners and things like that, but they're never 100%. So that's the first application. You go and say, tell me what you have from this, from this pool of information. And I get to take this and boil it down into something that makes sense to me. The next application of it is when you have all of these different axes where you can say, I want to find a laptop that's in Orange County, California that has, a gig and a half of RAM and a Windows key, right? And this reasoning system, this, semantic web agent, is able to go to all of these sites, and even if they're not speaking exactly the same language, they can reason out, well, this piece of information that I'm being provided is sort of like this piece of information. I can smash them together and they work. So all of these languages and all of these dialects are collected and end up making sense because there's a higher level reasoning engine that can put it all together. So I've gone way, I think, into geek world.
No, you haven't. Okay. Yeah, I'm following you on a generic level, in the sense that I've never had it explained that way before. It's starting to make a little more sense to me, in the sense that sometimes a frustration when I happen to be using a news aggregator and am looking through posts, I'll see something, and most people have this problem, and they'll have seen that post 10 other times before that day in the same news aggregator, and it wasn't linking them back to the other entries in the news aggregator. There was no direct relationship between those entries at all. So on the web, it works even in much the same way. Unless you hyperlink to a certain page, it wouldn't necessarily know. It would all be just HTML, a bunch of language. Whereas the semantic web breaks it down to specific things or keywords. Like you would search for keywords on a search engine, you would attribute certain keywords to, let's say, a set of data.
Yeah, well, you...
Kind of?
Kind of. You can have concepts that can be mapped. Like, I'm not going to do the whole car parts road type of analogy, but you know, when you're in you know, an object-oriented programming world, right? You have this object, right? It has properties and it has functions, methods, things it can do, and anything that meets that criterion has this, you know, all of these things attached to it. So when you get into figuring out these complex relationships, the fact that they are become usable within, you know, among each other, that you can start to capture the more complex details of things, and that the languages that you're speaking start to make a lot of sense, and you can draw even more interesting relationships out of it. Like, for example, the Genome Project, a lot of life sciences work, your genetic makeup have these properties, and you know, when you're dealing with drug interactions and things like that, they want to have, these are the enzymes, these are the drugs. What happens when I start throwing these things at each other?
Well, that's kind of how the web was invented. Here's a whole bunch of people. Here's some drugs. And what happens when you put them together? I'm sorry. My brain needs to take a break. Do you have any more music queued up for us before we head out of the first hour here?
Let's do the next two tracks. Since it's the top of the hour, we can take a little bit longer break here.
All right. And I just want to remind everybody, too, that we're going to be breaking up these particular hours. So if you're listening to this in the first hour, there's two other hours available of the Chris Perillo Show with Matt May.
Listen to the Chris Perillo Show live every Thursday at 7 p.m. Pacific.